You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. My name is John Allen, and I'm the president of the Brookings Institution. And it is my sincere pleasure to welcome you all to our online conversation on the critical role of public service in America today. This afternoon's webinar could not be more timely as our nation and the rest of the global community battle the COVID-19 pandemic. And as we mark the beginning of Public Service Recognition Week, a 35-year-old tradition honoring the individuals who serve and sacrifice our great nation, this is a particularly good moment for this conversation. We are pleased to partner today with the National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service, a bipartisan 11-member group created by the Congress to develop recommendations to inspire more Americans to participate in military, national, and public service and to review the military selective service process. Last March, after 2.5 years of research and public hearings and conversations with Americans across the country, the commission released its final report entitled Inspired to Serve. We at Brookings are honored and we're delighted to join forces with the commission today to highlight its outstanding work on this important topic and to discuss the conclusions of their extremely comprehensive report. Amidst the COVID-19 crisis, public service, even from afar, has never been more important. The service and the sacrifice of so many, from our cherished medical professionals and frontline healthcare workers, to our first responders and police, and those in our public and transportation systems, and those providing essential services in our utilities, and the tireless work of those who deliver to our homes. This work is service indeed, and it is critical to the integrity of our society as a nation. And for that, we truly thank them. Now, throughout my career, I've witnessed the transformative quality of service. Time and time again, when individuals from different walks of life have had the opportunity to serve their country and to do something bigger than themselves, they've lived up to the challenge and grown exponentially as a result. Indeed, they have regularly emerged as better citizens with strong bonds that last a lifetime. So it's my hope that in these difficult times for our local, state, and national communities, we can consider what service means for each and every one of us. After all, the service is not a singular experience designed for a few or even for personal gain. Rather, it is, as the commission's report properly puts and powerfully states, quote, a personal commitment of time and energy and talent to a mission that contributes to the public good, unquote. So with that, allow me to briefly introduce our panelists for today. First, the chairman of the commission, Joseph Heck, a brigadier general in the U.S. Army Reserve and a board-certified physician and a former member of the House of Representatives. There is no doubt that service was and remains a fixture in Joe's life. And I'd like to thank him for his leadership and for his service. And I'm delighted that he's able to join us here today. Alongside Joe is Avril Haines, a dear friend, and also a commissioner and a longtime friend of our institution at Brookings. Avril has had a distinguished career in intelligence and national security, having served as principal deputy national security advisor to President Obama, as well as Deputy Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Legal Advisor to the National Security Council, among other positions, many impressive positions. Avril, it's wonderful to have you with us again today.
Thank you so much.
Brookings community, we're joined by Bill Sawhill, Senior Fellow in the Economic Studies Program, as well as the architect and the biggest champion of Brookings' work on public and national service in recent years. And last but certainly not least, we're joined by Fiona Hill, who most recently served as Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Director for European and Russian Affairs at the National Security Council, and returned to Brookings in January as a senior fellow in our foreign policy program. A month and a half ago, I had the great honor of recording a podcast with Fiona on this very topic, national service. And I'm delighted that she's moderating this conversation today. So with that, a final reminder that we are on the record and we're streaming live today. So please send us your questions at events@brookings.edu or on Twitter using hashtag #inspire2serve, inspire to serve. Let me now offer the floor or the screen to our chairman, Joe Heck, to offer some of his remarks on behalf of the commission. Thank you all. Thank you to our panelists. Thank you for joining us today on this really important topic. Joe, over to you, please.
Well, thank you. Thank you, General Allen. And my thanks to Brookings as well for hosting us today yet again. Every public service recognition week is unique and special, and this is no exception, right? If there's one thing that the COVID-19 pandemic has shown us, it is the importance of public servants who are working tirelessly for our security and well-being. So I join General Allen in thanking these unsung heroes for the extraordinary service they provide to the American people and our nation. Their efforts and commitment to serving the public at a time of great need is truly exemplary. We know that thank you is not enough, and after seeing the critical role of service during the COVID-19 pandemic, service won't look the same moving forward. And that's why we're here today, to ask and perhaps answer the question, what does the future of public service entail? The commission spent the last 2.5 years asking that question, traveling the country, visiting urban centers, suburban neighborhoods, and rural towns. We spoke with elected leaders, nonprofit organizations, faith-based communities, middle school, high school, and college students, with those who serve and those who don't. And we found that, as was the case 200 years ago during the earliest days of our republic, America's extraordinary spirit of service continues to shape our nation. Americans repeatedly step up in support of each other, offering their sweat and ingenuity when needed, without expectation of anything in return. Yet, in a nation of 330 million, we have not unlocked the full transformational potential of service to address critical national and local needs and reinforce the very civic fabric of American society. Our vision is of a nation in which service is the common expectation and experience of all Americans, when it is the norm, not the exception, when every American is inspired and eager to serve. When every young person might consider a career in the military, in public service, or serving in a national service program like AmeriCorps, Senior Corps, or Peace Corps, making a difference while developing skills to help them in their future endeavors. Service, beginning at an early age and continuing throughout one's lifetime, develops skills and leadership among those who participate, maximizes federal investments in pursuit of local, state, and national solutions, helps develop the nation's workforce, and brings people together to meet the critical needs of the nation. By the year 2031, the 70th anniversary of President Kennedy's 1961 inaugural speech, in which he famously said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country," and challenged every American to contribute in some way to the public good, we envision 5 million Americans will begin to serve in military, national, or public service each and every year. This includes more than enough qualified individuals serving in the armed forces, minimizing the need for traditional military recruiting. 1 million individuals annually taking up federally supported national service opportunities, and a modernized government personnel system attracting and enabling Americans with critical skills and new generations to enter public service. Our long-term goal is to nurture the existing spirit of service into a culture of service in which individuals of all backgrounds are aware of, have access to, and aspire to participate in opportunities to serve their communities or country. You know, as Alexis de Tocqueville traveled our fledgling nation 200 years ago, he observed that America is, quote, a nation of joiners, end quote, distinctive for its rich tradition of individuals participating in civil society and faith organizations with a desire to serve community needs. And that's still true today. Americans answer the call to serve every day, and especially in times of crisis. Nearly 24 million individuals participate in some form of military, national, or public service. But we also know that 6% of the federal workforce is under the age of 30, with more than a third eligible to retire in the next 5 years. Nearly a third of millennials state that they are unaware of existing national service opportunities. And 41% of youth have never considered military service. So what does the future of service entail? Our report calls for a whole-of-government approach to coordinate and promote military, national, and public service, a significant investment in civic education, new and improved efforts to recruit public servants, increased awareness, enhanced benefits, and significantly expanded opportunities for Americans to participate in national service, and narrowing the civil-military divide and increasing awareness of military service to ensure today's military continues to attract the most qualified personnel. We believe the actions recommended in our report will empower Americans with broader knowledge of the fundamental principles of our republic, increase awareness of service options, and provide clear and supported pathways to military, national, and public service. Our report, the legislative annex, and additional supporting materials can be found on our website, inspiretoserve.gov. That's inspire2serve.gov. Now is the time, and Inspire to Serve is the plan, to strengthen service and achieve the vision of every American inspired and eager to serve. So I very much look forward to the upcoming panel discussion and your questions. Fiona, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Joe. I also want to thank everybody who is on the other side of this call today for joining us. As you have mentioned, it's the week that we actually celebrate and recognize public service. And I know that for many people outside of the public service sphere, this isn't a very well-known week of recognition. And, you know, I hope that at least by doing this event today and having so many people participate, we will also help to promote this somewhat. I mean, as you said, Joe, this has been going on for 35 years. And you've had quite a rocky road in doing the report for the commission as well. It was a huge effort, as you've outlined. You and Avril and many others took part in this as commissioners. Isabel Sawhill and some of my colleagues from Brookings were part of the larger group that you talked to. But your first interim report came out at quite a difficult time a year ago, right at the end of the longest shutdown for the federal government in history, 35 days in which many federal government employees were furloughed, including groups like the TSA and the Coast Guard and many other members of the federal government that I think a lot of the broader American public didn't even realize were part of the federal government apparatus. And of the 24 million people that you mentioned that are involved in some way of military and public and national service, only a small fraction of those, 2 million, are in fact in the federal government. There's a popular perception out there of a very large federal government apparatus, a lot of bloat and inefficiency. And unfortunately, in a recent Pew poll, only 17% of those polled had any overarching trust in the federal government to, as they were asked in the question, to do the right thing most of the time. So we've really unfortunately seen quite a decline in the popular opinion of public service for some period of time. And probably the nadir of that was during the furlough. Now you've come out with the full-time report in a very different atmosphere where we've seen public servants come to the forefront. And as you've said, you know, we're seeing the frontline responders. General Allen and others have, given great praise to the people who have stepped forward. We've seen Dr. Fauci, Anthony Fauci, one of the key people in the task force, when he's asked how he'd like to be remembered for dealing with this very difficult situation, saying he'd like to be remembered basically as a dedicated public servant. He was trying to do his best in a period of great adversity. So some of the questions that we've had coming in from the people who are listening today have been really about how this experience of the pandemic, of dealing with COVID-19, may have shifted the thinking about public service. Can we really say that there's been a shift over the course of this full year in which you put out the interim report and now you've put out the final report, which came out in March? Do you think there has been a perceptional shift? And if so, can we build on this momentum? And how would you like to see the commemoration of Public Service Week, say, a year from now, and looking forward into the future?
Who would you like to have start that?
Well, I'd like perhaps, you know, Joe to make a quick comment, and Avril, then to come to you too as a commissioner to give that and your perspective as well. Thank you.
Well, thanks, thanks, Fiona. And as you mentioned, the irony of releasing our interim report during the longest government shutdown, when we were talking about how to entice more people to enter public service, was not lost on us as a commission. I think, quite honestly, it's too early to tell whether or not there's been a shift based on the response to the COVID pandemic. Certainly, those of us that follow public service have seen individuals, again, perform heroically. And I think perhaps it's also expanded the definition of who is considered a public servant, right? So, you know, whether it's the school teacher who had to readjust their lesson plans or figure out how to educate their students via distance learning, whether it is the healthcare professionals, the nurses that are working in the emergency department, in many cases becoming infected themselves. So I think hopefully the big takeaway will be a greater expansion of who is considered a public servant. And I think you will still see those who want to try to call out the potential negative. People are, certain naysayers are going to be naysayers regardless of what happens, right? But I think there is a movement that is a fledgling movement based on the response. I think it'll expand the definition. Hopefully it will last longer than the post 9/11 bump, right? Mm-hmm. We tend to become a nation of complacency and forgetfulness, where we only remember things for a short period of time and then we go back to the status quo. I'm hoping that something like this, which has truly affected the entire nation in a degree heretofore unimaginable, will help elevate the imprimatur of those who are public servants.
That's great. Avril, if you're thinking about this as well, and you know, as we look forward to the next several years, I mean, some of the questions that we've had coming in that pick up on Joe's point about expanding the understanding of public service. We had one question, for example, about cultural leaders. We've seen, you know, right across the world, you know, Italians getting onto their balconies to sing, almost do entire operas. But we've seen orchestras from around the United States and internationally do free public performances on Zoom, you know, as we're doing, you know, today. We've seen all kinds of people trying to fill in those gaps for people to try to boost morale, but also in ways that, you know, we might be able to play forward. So one of the questions is also about, could cultural leaders play an increasing role in public service in the post COVID-19 future? Avril, how do you see this going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you so much. And I think Joe crystallized sort of the main points that I'd say about, you know, your first question before I get to the cultural leader piece. I think just to add to something he indicated, I think we are seeing a potential shift in the perception. And there was a Pew poll that was done recently that indicated really sort of significantly greater you know, positive impression of how federal institutions are addressing the pandemic. And in particular, I think it was something like 79% approval of CDC and, you know, 76% approval of HHS, of Health and Human Services. And so I think there's an opportunity, but it also, as Joe said, like, you can see a bump in these moments. And the question is, how do you carry that forward? How do you actually sort of, you know, to kind of reach that momentum and push it? And this is one of the great questions that I think we always experience in these moments of jolts, you know, to the system in our country. And I am hopeful, right, that we can take this opportunity to actually not just grasp the sort of the morale issues and the point about recognition of what it is that federal service does and correct some of the misimpressions, as you pointed out, even in your very question, right? But also to recognize the extraordinary value that not just public service, but national service and military service can bring across the range of issues to try to address a crisis like we have today. And I think that, you know, that's an element of the way our commission was established, was that it actually looks at all of these different areas of service and asks us to look at how can we increase an ethos and of service across these different areas. And I think that's sort of a fascinating way to think about it. And it really leads into your second part of your question. I mean, I think we are sort of hopefully reestablishing and rethinking how we consider service. And also, hopefully, through that process, we're able to strengthen our society and recognize the value that we have in different parts of our community and the different ways in which we address things. And I think one of the great values of services is, you know, even indicated in the opening remarks that John made, I think is just, it is an opportunity to not just to sort of step out of yourself and to experience empathy across our society, but also to create some coherence in our society and recognize how it is that we can help each other in these different communities and hopefully unite us at the same time that we're addressing the critical needs that we have across society. So I think you're right that we need to be thinking big in terms of the different ways in which we might actually promote addressing those needs, including through cultural leaders. But I also think the fact that, you know, a variety of experts have indicated that the potential need will be, say, hundreds of thousands of folks to help us with contact tracing in the context of COVID-19, right, is an example of how critical national and public service can be in these moments and the ability to surge forward on those types of issues. You know, it's just that is what will help us to actually ramp up in society, address some of the economic challenges that we would otherwise be addressing and so on. And so the value of service, I think, is no more sort of present than it is today through this lens.
Avril, just to push you out a little bit more on this, I mean, several of the questions, you know, have come in about non-military types of service and kind of selective service reform, and also wondering about how one might use this terrible crisis as the opportunity to push this forward. And obviously, within the Commission's report, which was written before the full dimensions of the pandemic became clear, you were thinking a lot about strengthening selective service and, you know, mobilization. And so thinking about how one might do this concretely for a national emergency, is there different ways in which we could bring together the dimensions of service that the Commission has laid out? And I just want to give an example from the United Kingdom, which obviously I, you know firsthand myself from, you know, my earlier part of my life. They have the Royal Voluntary Service, which has been helping the National Health Service. But it was initially set up on the eve of World War II in 1938 as the Women's Voluntary Service to organize for potential air raids and other, you know, national emergencies as a result of the anticipated at that point outbreak of war. And then has morphed in over time from 1938, all this time, into a sort of a standing national mobilization entity. What were you thinking in the terms of the commission about this and about these kind of larger roles that a more formalized service could take?
Yeah, so there's so many things to pull, you know, so many threads to pull out of your question, but let me just start with this. I think in going around to the, you know, 42 cities, 22 states that we did as we talked to people around service, there's a remarkable interest in actually engaging in service. I mean, I think the history of our country is one that surrounds itself in this area. And you see that, you know, people want to serve. However, the awareness of what the options are is actually quite low. And to your point, I think one piece of what we were trying to figure out is how do we increase awareness? How do we give people an opportunity to actually engage and see what they're interested in, what they can do, what skills they can bring to bear, and then make those connections and allow service to occur across a range of sectors in order to address not just, as you point out, the military pieces, but also sort of national emergencies more broadly. And one of the recommendations that we have is this service platform that really gives everybody an opportunity to get on to, you know, the website and sort of say, okay, there's all these different types of service. I can essentially register and sign up for a whole series of different things that might be available to us through that process. But that is sort of creating that awareness is obviously only one very small piece of this puzzle, which is to say that you need to also build the infrastructure in order to allow people to serve, give them both the aspiration and the access to it. And, you know, again, when you look at what we have right now, we have appropriations for only about 75,000 positions for AmeriCorps, our sort of major national service piece. You know, 250,000 is the goal that's currently in legislation. We indicate, you know, as Joe indicated, up to 1 million. We want to see 1 million slots provided for national service out of the 5 million that we're looking to actually promote for 2031. And I think, you know, building that infrastructure, getting the appropriations in terms of what are the concrete steps that need to happen, right? Building out all of those pieces that allow people to actually not just understand what's available, but then sign up, then have an option, and then be able to serve effectively, right? All of those are a piece of the puzzle, I think, to actually mobilizing what we have available to us. And if you think about it through the lens of just this particular emergency as a way to understand how valuable it can be, right? So imagine, if you will, a scenario in which you've already got essentially this kind of service platform available, right? And people have already signed up for their, you know, there might be a state ready reserve for healthcare workers, for example, which some states have, like in Colorado and other places, that would be available on this kind of a website for you to sign up to serve for, right? Other states can have those, the federal government can have those, and the FEMA Corps space, all of those things. And then we'd have those, basically that roster of folks that you could then mobilize really quite quickly. And moreover, it's not just mobilizing in the moment, in other words, having the list of people, right? But you may already have, as many places do, right, set up for the possibility of having that kind of training in advance, much like the National Guard does or others, you know, where you sort of have the ability to interact, understand what are the processes so that you can hit the ground running like this when you need to in the context of a national emergency, but you're bringing to bear the skills that you have available to you, essentially to the society when it needs it. And I think that's a critical aspect of this piece. But I think there's also, and I know Bell and others have talked about this in their work and you as well, I think uniting the country behind these kinds of moments is really one of those, you know, it's an element that I think is so important to our work. And I think, you know, our commission was a kind of a microcosm of it in a sense, a bipartisan commission. I mean, you couldn't imagine with our leader in Joe Heck and really the cooperative sort of style among all of us and the remarkable degree of collaboration and unity over the importance of service was quite astonishing. And I think belies some of the divisions that we see otherwise.
Well, that's great, Avril. I mean, I think we've got a lot of things to think about here. Bell, you back in February wrote an opinion piece in the Washington Post in their section, which is looking for common ground, trying to bridge the divides that Avril's talking about, you know, trying to make things non-partisan. And you tried to pull that thread, Bell, of an idea of a voluntary national service so that people could mobilize and could find ways to serve, but with a more of a sort of centralized portal to sort of address some of the issues that Avril was pulling out there. Do you want to come in on this and a few more thoughts? And then I thought I'd ask John to give us some of his perspective from the military, and I'll pull those questions out a little bit after this. But Bell, how are you thinking about this? And I know you've been very active with the commission, and lots of people, of course, have been proposing this idea, but perhaps you could tell us a little bit about what you were thinking in the context of your interactions with the commission.
Sure, happy to do that. And thanks for including me. I really would like to just say at the very start here that I am so impressed with this report. And I just want to congratulate the commission, its leadership, its staff. I'm quite fussy about reports, and usually the reports I read, I can find something wrong with them. I couldn't find much wrong with this report. Some reports have a lot of specific recommendations, but no sort of overarching animus or theme. And some reports have a lot of grandiose language, but no actionable items. This report has some of both, and I really like that about it. I mean, this call to service that the report and the commission begins with, the idea that every American should be expected to serve in one way or another, whether it's in the military, whether it's working for the government in public service, or whether it's through voluntary national service, that the idea that as citizens, we have rights, but we also have responsibilities, is, I think, exactly the right tone and very much needed right now. I am concerned, by the way, to go back to your earlier conversation about shutdowns and public service more generally, that we have gotten into a mode in this country where the public does not trust government, especially the federal government. They have more confidence in state and local government. And there was a bump, as was said earlier, after 9/11, but there wasn't the leadership to carry that bump forward. And I think this is another point at which we can re-inspire people, and this report can do that. So I just hope it gets a lot of attention. On the whole idea of national service and what I wrote the Washington Post article about with John Bridgeland, whom, by the way, has been an absolutely wonderful advocate for this. I served in the Clinton administration. He served in the Bush administration. So once again, this was just a very bipartisan effort. And we both believe that there's lots of bipartisan support out there for the kind of ideas that are in this report. But the reason we like this idea of a greater investment in national service, voluntary national service, is because it's very popular. 4 out of 5 Americans want to see more national service. There are many more people raising their hand to serve, applying for service slots through AmeriCorps or the Peace Corps or Senior Corps or something else, then there are opportunities to serve. When I went out and did focus groups in 2018 with middle-class and working-class Americans around the country, and I tried out all of my standard Brookings proposals on them, the proposal they liked best by far was this one. Let's make national service universal, especially for younger people. It should be a rite of passage into adulthood. We can come back to civic education because I think that's a priority that the commission underscored, better civic education and from kindergarten right through high school. I'd like to come back to that. But we have a elderly population, I mean, an aging population, I should say. I'm in that category. Many of my friends are looking for ways to serve. They don't see where the opportunities are. So there's a demand to serve. And what we need is the kind of platforms and the kind of resources and so forth that the commission has talked about, a council and the White House itself, and so forth. Now, you ask about one of the benefits that I think universal national service would bring, and that is that I have stressed in my own work, and that is reducing our divisions. You know, as we all know, we're very divided now as a country, whether it's by political affiliation or by race or religion or by geography or something else. And I've been very impressed in the very serious research, robust, rigorous research that I've read, mostly by psychologists, that shows that if you want to bring people together, if you want to bridge some of these divisions, the best way to do so, and there's really good evidence on this, is to bring people together to work on a set of common tasks and to learn about people with very different backgrounds and experiences than their own. I mean, the military is the classic example there. People who have served together in the military, and I'm sure the two military people on this panel can attest to this, people who have served together, they bond, they form friendships across unusual lines. So I really do think that this could end some of our divisions and some of our tribalism. I'll stop there. I could say much more.
Thank you very much, Bal, and you gave me a very good segue into posing to John and then, you know, Joe about this interaction with military service. Another element of actually the federal government is about a third of federal government employees are veterans. And from my own experience inside of the federal government on two tours of service there, I think the people with the most diverse backgrounds who I met had actually come out of the military. Because some of the questions that we're getting in from the audience members today are really questions about how do you increase the diversity of people stepping up for public service? You know, the statistics that show fewer younger people, you've got a lot of people aging out now in the federal government in particular, but more broadly, minorities, women, all underrepresented in the federal government, but, you know, certainly not in other parts of state and local government service, and not in the military, which has done an awful lot to bring people of diverse backgrounds in. So, I mean, I wonder, John and then Joe, if you'd like to comment on this, because both of you are people who served in the military and, like many other military veterans, signed up for other forms of public service. And this is obviously something that veterans in particular are encouraged to do. But, you know, how could we build up on some of that experience as we think about broadening out national service? Because I do think that there's a bit of skepticism coming out in the questions that we're getting from audience members about how would we do this and how we would ensure that this is more reflective of the public at large and the diversity of the American population. So John and then Joe.
Sure. It's a great question. But, you know, first, again, congratulations to the commission, because I think you've shown a light on some real opportunity for us. I mean, a couple of points that relate to everything that has been said so far. Civic education is really essential to creating what I would consider to be habits of service that we need to instill in our population at a very young age. That plus local volunteerism, the idea of doing something for others and being part of a volunteer group that does that stands for something bigger than themselves. Because what all that does is it begins ultimately to contribute to that which we value, I think, the most in our military, which is a commitment to selfless service based on the principles of our Constitution, something that we're willing to sacrifice a lot to preserve. And so I think that what you see, at least in the military today, and I know that there are other institutions in U.S. civil society, but in the U.S. government, is that the military has worked very, very hard to achieve diversity. And I think there isn't a military commander that I know out there that would say that there is an objective to be achieved. It's a journey to be achieved. And you don't ever arrive at diversity. It's something you have to work at all the time. And the experience of serving in a unit where you are mixed in inherently with people of all walks of life, regardless of how you would categorize those walks of life, that is of enormous value. So first, you have the opportunity to serve with people with very diverse views, from very diverse backgrounds, varying religions, gender, all of those things that are important qualities of the diverse experience. And doing it in a unit or an organization where you have a shared experience of camaraderie that creates relationships within that organization, but then habits of relationships, so that when the large numbers of our troops who matriculate out of the service every year return to American society, they can return directly into local and state government or local societies and be leaders there as well and represent those values associated with our embracing diversity for the strength of that, as opposed to the very difficult, sometimes disintegrating trends and energies that we see today, where people are pulled apart rather than unified. And what we see from the military is you get those kinds of experiences of being something, part of something bigger than yourself, selfless commitment to those around you, but selfless commitment to a set of principles above you. And then when you finish that service, whether it's a short enlistment or it's a long-term career, returning then to civil society and carrying those qualities with you. So many military end up in our classrooms. I think that's a wonderful thing. And they embody for the young students, and this goes back to the issue of civic education, they embody for those students those habits of leadership, those habits of volunteerism, those habits of commitment to the best aspects of diversity, which is a unified population that stands for something. Boy, that's a powerful, powerful contribution. And there was a commandant in the Marine Corps we had a few years ago. I'll just draw on my own service. He used to say that Marine Corps does two things for our country. It fights the nation's battles, but it makes Marines. And what he meant by that was the Marines who take their uniform off and go home and still carry those values of service, those values of selflessness, those values of commitment, carry that home to civil society and stand for something there, and in that way, become an example for others. So the military is a very important feeder into civil society of the very values that we seek to emulate through national service.
Thanks so much, John. Joe, in the report, this point about inculcating the spirit of public, national, and military service comes out very clearly. And it also equates, in many respects, kind of civic education as almost as sort of a national security imperative. In fact, there's been lots of analysts and commentators writing op-eds and articles about this link between civics education and national security. And of course, we've seen a major decline outside of the military, where John has very eloquently described that sense of civic duty that's also built into military service and the civics education, and how, so many veterans then go on to teach and to do all kinds of other public service. How could you, see, and which you've outlined in the report, moving forward, embedding public service, that sense of public service, in civics education? And I think, the statistics are it's less than 10 states now have civics as part of their curriculum. Obviously, a number of private schools, have that. But how could we think about what John has just said about that military ethos, somehow providing that in the rest of the educational system? How were you thinking about that from your own military service when you were chairing the commission?
So great question. So I think, building on what both Bell and General Allen said, very few organizations that I'm aware of other than the military bring people together from disparate backgrounds who, after a period of time together, leave calling each other brother and sister. And that is the goal, to bring people together from different demographics and have them view each other as brothers and sisters. And I think that service experience is what then propagates that military veteran into some other form of service. We saw this. We, on our travels, visited with a group from Senior Corps outside of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. A group of aging retirees who now decide that they want to give back to their community, whether it's, visiting with homebound seniors, tutoring at-risk youth, providing meals. And so I asked them, what their background was previously and what made them get into Senior Corps, right? So almost invariably, all the men were prior service. Women were either prior service, nurses, or school teachers. So somebody who had a service ethos already embedded within them. So to the question of how do we expand this and how do we get it into different demographics, so I'm a physician, right? So everything for me is a medical analogy. So, I believe that everybody has a service gene, and the goal is, how do we activate that gene? Because we know historically that if somebody participates in a service opportunity and it was a meaningful, fulfilling experience for them, they will continue to serve throughout their lives, right? So how do we start that earlier? So we started with civic education and making sure that youth understand, as Bell said earlier, that it's not just about your rights as a citizen, but your responsibilities as a citizen. How can you ask someone to give to a country, to a community, to a state, when they have no idea about how we were formed as a nation, as a state, as a community? And this came to me as well. We were in Denver visiting a high school in an at-risk community. And quite honestly, one of the students, as we were talking about service opportunities, said to me, why would I want to give back to a country that I don't believe is given to me? Right. And so we had to talk about, well, it's not just, you know, national service. You can give right here in your community. And all of a sudden, eyes were wide open. Right. And so we start with civic education. And I think also important is the follow-on service learning piece that we put in. Right. So we talk about a maybe finite service project in the middle school years. You know, here's a certain project that you're going to do as a middle school student to show you what service is about. We talk about semesters of service in high school, where there's a semester-long service project you undertake as a high school junior or senior before you graduate. And then we talk about a very groundbreaking program, which is a service fellowship program, where it's you don't have to participate in a already preordained federal government program, but go find an opportunity in your local community, and the money will follow you, right? Go to a certified nonprofit, say that you want to work with them as a fellow, and the money, the 1 million folks that we want to support every year, that will come to you wherever you are. So it's not necessarily having to grow more of the national service programs based in Washington, D.C. And I think if we take that approach, civic education, rights and responsibilities as a citizen, a specific service project in middle school, a service of semester in high school, a fellowship post-high school, we will activate that service gene. And you will then have individuals participate in service when appropriate and when convenient for them throughout their lifetime.
I mean, this is a great vision. I mean, I know from many of the questions that we're getting in, how do we make it happen? And obviously the commission, you didn't just lay out the vision, you actually came up with some recommendations. So, I mean, I'd like to ask you and Avril about, first of all, the resources that we would need to do this. And then also, I mean, some of the obstacles that we're going to have to overcome. I mean, again, one of them is the low opinion that people have had, of, at least at the federal government level. And there's often a conflation of federal government public service when really, as you're talking about, there's communities, there's local municipal service, there's state level. I think in some of the research that Brookings and other colleagues have done, you know, people also have a somewhat lower opinion of state level service too, but their communities and their immediate surroundings, that certainly gets people motivated because they want to see results and they want to really, you know, have a feeling that they're doing something and that they're having an impact. But how then were you envisaging legislation, the kind of resources that are needed at all the different levels of this?
Avril, do you want to go first? Uh-huh. So, well, first, right, we have many recommendations, 164 to be precise, within the report. We also did a legislative annex. So we actually hired a former House of Representatives bill drafter to come in and put all of this into legislative language so that, any member of the House or Senate who wanted to utilize this, it's already drafted for them. Tried to make it as easy as possible, understanding that, you know, an omnibus bill like that, which would take multiple sequential committee referrals, is unlikely to make it to the finish line, but provides a cut and paste opportunity for people who like specific pieces of it, right? No matter where you come from on the political spectrum, there is something in that legislative annex that you will like. And we hope that we can get folks to pick and choose what they like and move it forward. Now, the only areas that we actually directly assigned a cost to were to the civic education piece and the service learning piece. Civic education, $200 million a year, service learning, $250 million a year, in part to call out the very apparent lack of federal support for both of these things, right? So civic education funding has dropped from 2010 to now from $150 million a year to $5 million a year. The federal government spends $54 per student on STEM and 5 cents per student on civic education. So we did it in order to actually call out what we believe is the injustice about how civic education and service learning is viewed within the federal bureaucracy. Now, we know that there are other costs associated, right? You want to grow national service opportunities, and you will hear people argue the counterpoint. That's been tried before, right? The Edward M. Kennedy Serve America Act called for 250,000 national service program slots, which were authorized but never appropriated. So the authorization's there, but the money's not. And we try to make the argument that this is about investing a dollar today to serve, to save that $4 or $5 on the back end. We know the studies have shown that for every dollar invested in national service, the investor, in this case, the federal government, will recoup $3 to $4 on the back end in lower use of social safety nets, of lower criminal justice issues, right? So we've got to make that case. We show that there, if you give that person, as I mentioned, a meaningful service opportunity earlier, they will continue to serve and give back throughout their lifetime. So it's like compounded interest. I mean, it just keeps giving back over and over again. And those are the arguments that we need to bring forward, you know, very vociferously to those who may still be an opponent, not necessarily of service, but of the federal government's funding of the programs. And I'll give Avril an opportunity, but she was instrumental in pulling together a lot of these recommendations in this area.
Yeah, and Avril, perhaps you could also think about whether there's a public-private component to this as well.
I was going to mention
that. Would be great to hear some of your thinking on that too.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, so in addition to the legislative proposals, I think, you know, another piece of what Joe's saying too is that, first of all, it takes leadership from the executive branch. So it just to highlight a few things on that and then get to your public-private point, I think one of the recommendations we make is this council that would exist at the White House, and it would be one that would be stretching across the service areas and sort of promote and coordinate the work that's being done on service. And we see that as absolutely critical, frankly, to driving the kind of action that we see as necessary in order to do what it is that we want to do in creating this, ultimately, this culture of service and this expectation of service that's universal. The second piece I'll just note in that context is, you know, we make a lot of recommendations that are present in part in the legislative proposal that relate to the public service piece. So just coming back to the beginning of our conversation and how critical it is to have, you know, frankly, a far more flexible, less outdated personnel system that's really based on talent management as opposed to the current structure. You know, dealing with USA jobs and just a total overhaul of that, thinking about more flexible benefit opportunities so that you can have and attract and retain, frankly, the talent that's in this next generation that doesn't think about spending a 30-year career in the federal government, but wants to go in and out and use their talents as they can. So a whole series of things that require both legislation and executive action, because there's actually a lot of authorities we found that exist for the executive branch that aren't being used, frankly, to create the kind of atmosphere and the talent management system that we see as valuable. So there's so much more to be said, but leadership, as Bell said, really, from the executive branch is a critical aspect of this. But another point is we talk about and we call out in the context of our recommendations, both institutes of higher education and the private sector in particular. And the fact is there's a lot that these sectors can do to contribute to creating the kind of culture of service that we're interested in promoting. And it's from the institutes of higher education perspective, you have much to say in relation to what's already been said on the civics education and service learning. Obviously, institutes of higher education can help to train the teachers that work through the K-12 education that we'd like to see have happen in civics education and in service learning spaces. But also to accentuate those, to create the curriculums, to, you know, really promote these areas in ways that they haven't been for some time. And then secondly, you know, is thinking about it in admissions, right? Like having an expectation and a recognition of how valuable it is for students to experience service and to contribute in that way, I think is a piece of what we'd like to see as part of this universal expectation of service and a recognition of the value that it provides, not just for the society, but for the actual individuals who are engaging in it, both professionally and personally. So I think that's another piece of it. But then also, frankly, focusing in on the kinds of talents and skills that are needed in public service and really trying to drive education in a way that helps to promote that. Because I think I know that John and Fiona, both of you and Joe as well, and Bell probably too, but all of us that have spent so much time on national security and foreign policy recognize how critical it is, frankly, that we actually are able to mobilize the talent that exists in this country to make us as competitive as we need to be to address the threats of the future. So I think that's a critical aspect of what can be done. In the private sector, we had a number of business roundtable discussions and other things, really remarkable degree of support generally for service. But, you know, we sort of highlighted some of the spaces where rubber meets the road for them, which is, you know, actually seeing service as something that's valuable in their employees and recognizing that when they're hiring and recognizing the value that leadership can bring from service into their organizations and seeing that as part of their thinking, right? Also promoting service from the private sector and engaging in it and, you know, and recognizing, frankly, the value that service from the federal government and, as you point out, state and local and tribal authorities, all of these combine. And it's not just about service in these different spaces, but if you look at AmeriCorps volunteers today, for example, who are helping to promote and address the COVID-19 crisis, many of them are doing things where they are supporting state and local emergency responders, right? So it's a there's a real continued sort of integration of service across these ranges that needs to be recognized and promoted by all of these different sectors of society.
Now that's great. John, actually, I'd like to bring you and then Bell in on this as well. Avril really laid out a very large universe there. I mean, obviously, for think tanks like Brookings, you know, which were set up more than 100 years ago, also with a view to trying to help make government more effective and to think about many of these problems. I mean, people like Bell, you know, spend all of their day trying to figure out how to address some of these, you know, critical issues that are facing the nation and come up with some practical solutions. Some of the questions that we've also got in have focused on how can you globalize this thinking. I mean, obviously, we're trying to figure out how to deal with crises that America is facing and to mobilize our population to deal with challenges that, you know, are intrinsic to us. But there's also, you know, very much an international dimension to this, particularly when you're dealing with a global pandemic. There are best practices that one can pick up. I mentioned the Royal Voluntary Service in the United Kingdom, you know, which is really kind of one of the things that we're talking about here, this how do you mobilize a nation, really, at all kinds of different levels to deal with a crisis. And it was set up just with the anticipation of World War II and has continued all of that time. I mean, John, perhaps you could give us, you know, a little bit of an insight to how you've been thinking about this from leaving your military service to then, you know, heading up a public facing institution like Brookings that's grappling with this, and how we might think of this in international sense. We've got some people from the United Nations who are writing in, you know, reminding us that, you know, the United Nations, again, another organization that's been maligned over time, was actually set up in the work of all of these disasters of the 20th century, especially World War II, to try to deal with many of these problems. I'd be interested to hear about, you know, some of the thoughts you've had, John.
Well, a couple of things. You know, first, one of the reasons that the United States has been as influential as it has around the world for so many reasons and for so long is because we have believed in multilateralism. It's never been about the United States alone. It has always been about the United States within a community of nations, a community of nations that either shares our values or shares our interests. And we're able to accomplish a lot in that regard. For example, as Avril said very well, and as Joe has said, administration leadership is really important at a moment like this. And I'm not going to get into the critique right now of how we're doing in that regard, but as we think about an opportunity that has been presented to us right now, this opportunity for the United States to lead the community of nations in dealing with this pandemic, to get after its basic causal factors, to create resilience in the world's economy and societies, to resolve this if it ever breaks out again. And then one of the things that this pandemic has really done is it has exposed inequality in the world. And here's an opportunity for the United States and the community of nations. We call it at Brookings the community of democracies, but more broadly, the community of nations who are willing to share in that responsibility to deal with the inequality that we have faced in the world, which this now gives us an opportunity to truly focus our efforts to deal with. But the United States brings a couple of things to every crisis in a multilateral sense around the world. And one is the convening power from the moral suasion of our leadership. And this is what we need to be exerting right now. And this is what's made us truly the great country that we are. Our capacity to live our values and to extend those values. And this is a moment when we really need to discover that and extend those values first on the pandemic, but more broadly. Here is an opportunity in the 21st century for us to recognize what has laid bare so many of the problems in the multilateral world and to try to take steps to embrace the solutions and to organize and lead the community of nations in dealing with that. And I think this is a rare moment. You know, often these kinds of visionary moments come from a trauma, whether it's a war or it's a massive a disaster of some form or another. I was involved in the South Asian tsunami. Many things changed there for the better in the aftermath of that. Here is an opportunity we should not miss to reestablish and reaffirm our belief in the United Nations, our belief in multilateral organizations, and our willingness as a nation to lead in a multilateral sense, living our values, extending our values, ultimately to solve this problem. And if we miss this, history will not be kind to the United States at this moment.
And this is a very important message, John. Bell, when you were going around and talking to people as you were fleshing out the idea of the national public service, you know, obviously a lot of people wanted it to be voluntary, not mandatory. But I mean, how do you think that many of the people that you were talking to would react to, you know, John's appeal for, you know, the United States returning to a sense of global leadership in terms of also setting a standard for voluntary public service? So, do you think this is something that would resonate with people?
Well, to be honest, when you go out and talk to ordinary citizens, and I was talking to people without college degrees, none of the people I talked to were what we would call part of the elite. They don't think a lot about the international aspects of this. I obviously totally agree with John on what he just said, but I want to be realistic that this is not something that your average American gets up and worries about. And I want to go back to, therefore, the whole idea of civic education, which can include ways in which we are connected to the rest of the world, and understanding all of that a little bit better. And I think that the commission's work in that area is really, really important. I mean, you know, people are shocked when you tell them that 22% of Americans can't name even one branch of government. They're maybe even more shocked when you tell them that 37% don't even know one right that's guaranteed by the First Amendment. Think about that. Now, I have friends who volunteer at these citizenship ceremonies when immigrants are naturalized, and they tell me those ceremonies are very moving. The test you have to take to become a U.S. citizen is quite tough. I'm afraid most of our high school students couldn't pass it. They should be exposed to tests of that sort, and they should be asked to go to such a ceremony before they graduate from high school. I think they would learn that people from other countries are very eager to become U.S. citizens, but they do need to learn about what life is like if you're not a U.S. citizen.
Well, I can certainly attest to that, Bell, as a naturalized citizen, that, you know, I found the civics educational part of that not just very interesting and necessary, but also very moving. And I have to say, you know, taking part in that naturalization ceremony was a very important event for me. And I was really struck just at the diversity and just the great upwelling of positive emotion of the people that I naturalized with. I mean, it was in a sort of rather faceless building up in Baltimore, but it was one of the most moving occasions in my life. And I do think that, you know, finding a way back to civics education is very valuable. And I'd like to turn back to, you know, Joe on this. I mean, when we start thinking about a return to this, back to civics education, I mean, what do you think is the main obstacle here? I mean, I worry a little bit about the politicization of everything right now. I mean, obviously, public service ought to be apolitical. There are all kinds of issues that shouldn't be politicized. Public health is an obvious one as we're trying to deal with this crisis, but national security, so many different aspects. And I do know from my own extended family in the US, the family I married into, but I also have, you know, relatives here, many of them, you know, have jobs as teachers and first responders and nurses. And they do tend to have a sense of solidarity, not just with the US, but with other people going through emergencies worldwide. I mean, we've seen our first responders, firemen, people who deal with earthquakes and search and rescue going out to other countries to help when they're called upon to do so. Nurses, you know, going around the world as well as around the country. So many people who have signed up to go and help in New York from all the way across the country. I mean, how do we tackle some of this too, so that people are politically aware and aware of the kind of need for action service, but are not, it's not politicized in some way? How did you feel, I mean, you know, somebody who has really tried to have a bipartisan approach to something, how did you feel we could overcome this, Joe?
Yeah, that's a great question, Fiona. So it's, you know, it's interesting to get the backstory of how we actually included civic education as one of our recommendations, one of our topic areas, because it was not one of the charges that was included in our mandate from Congress, nor was it one of the guiding principles given to us by the president. But as we traveled around the country and talked with people about service, it was the American public that brought up the importance of civic education and the current lack thereof. So it appears to me that there is a hunger and a thirst for civic education to be brought back into the curriculum. What are the issues that we face? Well, there's only so many hours in a school day, right? And so as you focus on one area, something else has to give. And with the last decade's emphasis on STEM education, we've seen a lot of other topics and subjects be pushed to the side to meet the time frame of a school day. You know, it's not just civic education, but most of the social studies, things like vo-tech, shop, home ec, the arts are all being pushed aside. And so we have to strike the balance, right? Yes, STEM education is important, but if you don't have a fundamental understanding of this country and how we function, having a STEM education really isn't going to be of much benefit. So that's one piece. The other piece, of course, is always funding, right? We ask local school districts to continue to do more with decreasing federal dollars. As I mentioned, the amount that was formally appropriated to this area and how it's declined over the last decade. So that's why we call for the service grants and the civic education grants to help provide the seed money, if you will, for schools. We also talk about the importance of an assessment of the progress, right? There has to be a return on the investment. And so, you know, the National Association of Educational Progress has a civic education exam. Unfortunately, most students right now do not score proficient on that exam, nor is it required really to be given at certain intervals. It's one of the optional exams that's available. So we need to look at that as well. And I think the last piece is that this does not have to, we're not talking about, okay, you're going to take one semester of American history and U.S. government and that checks the box. You can weave civic education into every subject that's being taught. And that's how you inculcate this generational change. It's not by taking one class and, you know, getting the B grade and having it on your report card. It's how do you really make it a very part of a person's being and fiber. And the only way you're going to do that is to weave it through every class that they take. And so that's how we look at trying to move the civic education program forward. We do have best practices in our appendix to the report. Some states are doing phenomenally well, others not so much, but we do have some really good best practices. We did a lot of work with the iCivic program in looking at how they would move this ahead. And so they're out there. We just have to provide the momentum to the school districts and to the states to try to implement.
Well, that's great. I mean, especially the idea of weaving things in. I mean, Avril, I wonder if you'd like to, you know, elaborate on this a little bit as well. I mean, as somebody who's been in and out of the federal government, I'm sure, like me, you were struck by how many of your colleagues had an experience in which their school had brought them to Washington, D.C. to meet with their congressman or the senator, or they'd had, in the past, a civics education class, and that's how they'd been inspired. I mean, I have to say that my experience in the National Security Council, also the National Intelligence Council, I was struck by, you know, just the diversity of the walks of life that my, fellow public servants had come from. Many of them came from really poor, impoverished backgrounds from all the way across the United States, but they all had in common, again, either military service and that they were veterans, or a great experience of civics education, a great teacher, or a moment where they met their congressman or the senator, or they took part in some school trip to Washington, D.C., or the state capital. And that was what inspired them to serve later. So overall, I mean, I wonder if you've had any more thoughts to elaborate on what Joe said there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think one small point and then a broader point, just in the context of what you were saying, service learning is another area where, as Joe indicated with civics education, where you can actually pull things in across a whole range of topics. And we were fascinated in talking to different teachers in schools across the country for, you know, their creative approaches to these issues. But, you know, you can be in a biology class and there's a service learning component of it, right, where they're actually taking biology and using that expertise to show how you can actually engage in service through these processes. And that's a remarkable, it's just a very inspiring thing to see people who are very focused on their particular, you know, kind of expertise, but nevertheless recognizing this value. And as we've been saying throughout the discussion, I mean, I think it is, the data demonstrates this, but certainly this is consistent with my own experience, and it sounds like yours too, Fiona, which is just how once you get hooked, it's hard not to, you know, continue. In other words, once you serve once, the clear indication is that you're more likely to serve again, and that happens across a range of issues. But I wanted to sort of, to your broader point, just comment on my particular parochial perspective on this. And I think, you know, John's comments resonate with me very much in terms of the degree to which we require multilateralism and need to engage multilaterally in order to promote our own interests and to see ourselves and our allies and others survive and thrive. I think the lens through which I've seen this from a national security standpoint, in addition to the competitiveness point that I made earlier, and Fiona, I think you've spoken particularly eloquently on this, I think the divisions in our country are ones that, you know, I've seen adversaries exploit ultimately. And these are, you know, vulnerabilities in our democracy in a sense. And in addition, I think another critical aspect of this from my perspective in terms of actually trying to address national security and foreign policy issues is that the divisions in our country make us less capable of responding to those adversaries when they do, in fact, exploit those activities. And as a consequence, I've come in my national security and foreign policy professional experience to believe that if we don't address those issues, that actually is going to be the long pole in the tent to addressing our national security and our foreign policy. And I think you can make the argument quite persuasively to people around the country who do care about our national security. And you see in the polls that exist, you know, among folks who are more skeptical about sometimes multilateral engagements through international organizations and trade and so on, recognize the value that they have gotten out of it from a national security standpoint, from a peace and prosperity standpoint coming out of World War II and otherwise. And I think that is something that I believe service can actually help combat. And I think that's a, you know, obviously it's been an underlying point that we've all made in different ways, but the reality is service can actually bring us together in ways that nothing else seems to be able to do it. And it is something that, you know, through these experiences, we see the value of service to actually heal these divisions. But coming back to some of the questions that you were getting at, it's only going to work if we actually develop the diversity that, you know, people are asking about in service. We recognize that, you know, for the military, most of our accessions come from the American Southwest, that, you know, in fact, 40%, I think, come from five states. You know, so we see the need for increasing the diversity of who serves in the military across the geography. That goes to the civilian-military divide that Joe mentioned, whole series of things like that. We have recommendations specifically to try to address those issues, right? And we recognize the value of actually promoting service in all of these different areas, including addressing some of the inequality issues that were mentioned. And I think, you know, service is another place where we can act, we have the most, you know, extraordinary gap of inequality of all advanced economies. That's something we need to address. So this is another place where we're able to actually make some moves in that space to do something about it. So I think it's a really, it's an interesting, you know, I feel as if all of us come at this issue from different perspectives, but there's real value in solving many of our problems through this lens.
Well, this is wonderful, Everett. I think you've actually given us a good concluding overview here, because very sadly, you know, we're out of time. We had to wrap up at 3:15, and I think that's, you know, where we are now. I would just like to thank all of you on behalf of Brookings and all of my colleagues for participating in this. And I know that John is very eager, you know, for all of us to help out more on inspiring people to public service. It's the ethos of Brookings itself. It's why Mr. Brookings and his family endowed the institution more than 100 years ago to help in increasing the effectiveness of our government. And that can only be done when people are mobilized behind that, not just in support of government in a kind of a popular opinion fashion, but actually actively taking part in it. And I think this whole message of your report, Joe and Avril and all of the commissioners, was that we all have agency. We can all do something. And, you know, as you said, Joe, in your opening remarks, we're looking forward next year to the 60th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's call to service. But 10 years out, for the 70th anniversary, you'd like to see millions more Americans actually actively engaged in public service. And that seems to me not just an admirable vision, but a realistic goal if we can all pull together. And with Bell and other colleagues at Brookings who are looking at that voluntary service and at civics education, you know, hopefully we can keep a role in this space too. So we'd like to congratulate the Commission again on this fabulous report. Thank all of our audience members for taking part in this. We've really had a great set of questions coming in and a very large and diverse audience. And we wish you luck in the promotion of the report going forward. So thank you so much, Avril, and to Joe. And congratulations on just an amazing work over the last 2 years. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Be well.
Be well.